So again, thank you for coming. So as usual, before we begin our formal presentation tonight, formal Dharma talk, we always have time if anyone has any questions about practice, meditative practice, practice in their daily life. Rarely in this life, in the type of lives we lead and the busyness and the activities, do we have time to set aside ourselves from our life of activity and just to step back and to reflect, meditate, and to think about our life and our hopes to lead a more happier life, or a more purposeful life, a more altruistic life, a life of greater joy and personal ease, both within ourselves as well as importantly, in our relationship with others. But for all kinds of reasons, which are obvious if we attend to them, sometimes we do better at it than other times. People turn Buddhism or Dharma into a thing, you know, like it's a philosophy or, it's something to be practiced and mastered as if it has nothing to do with our moment-to-moment reality. Buddhist practice has everything to do with our moment-to-moment reality and is about the transformation of our life. So again, how to go about that? Because life's a little messy, and things don't always proceed the way we'd like them to, nor do people always act the way we'd like them to, and nor do we always act in the way we like ourselves to. So it gets kind of messy. And so therefore, it is good that we have an opportunity to step back and to look more deeply at our life. And so if anything, anybody has any questions as they look at their life and their practice in terms of how to apply the practices of mindfulness, the practices of the Buddha's Dharma to the reality of the situations we're living in, so we can live more skillfully, live more harmoniously, with greater ease and purpose, please feel free to ask any question you'd like. So this means everybody, there's nobody thinking anything. Oh, one person. One lost soul in this room full of enlightened beings. How can we help you, Charlie? Do not ponder others. And what were you reading?
Well, it was the kind of a list. I knew, like,
are those the Lojong, the slogans? Lojong. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Do not ponder others. Mm-hmm. Actually, the translation, actually, I have it here. I think the translation I have is actually a little different. But my best guess, without going into it, I think it's good advice, because whether we say do not ponder others, do not focus on others, I'm kind of calling it a worldly people, but that means really us when we're kind of being turned by our world. We are very focused on others, right? Trying to understand them, try to figure them out, offering them advice. You know what I mean? We are constantly involved in the external world and other people, and I mean that's our life. But I think what the teacher is saying about pondering is, you know, don't always be thinking about them. If there's anybody you should be pondering in this life, is yourself. Right? Because spending your life pondering others, what's wrong with them, or, you know, more likely we ponder as others thinking we're right, and if only they would do it our way, listen to us or something, you know. But we're great at figuring out other people, and we're great at figuring out what they should be doing. But if we have any deficiency, is to really figure ourselves out and to then follow our own good advice. So I think, you know, I think what the teacher is saying, and again, those lojongs are wonderful. They really go from the simplest to the most profound. But as you're pointing out, many of them deal with very simple aspects of daily life that if one paid attention to, one would get a lot more mileage and stop wasting so much time. So again, I think if we gave up for Lent our overriding obsession and concern with everybody else's behavior and became as concerned about our own behavior, and especially tried to figure out why is it that even though I know better, even though I've read all the books, even though I've, you know, have dedicated myself to selflessness or altruism, you know, and to kind of see more clearly, I still just go down the same old paths continually. And that's worth pondering. Good advice. Yeah, we need to ponder our own life. So if there's one person we need to understand in this life, it's ourself. Why? Because we are the cause of our sorrow and we are the cause of our happiness. There's no one else. Right? And so even if we are the greatest experts on everybody else, and you know, physician, heal thyself, good advice. So if there's anybody in this world that we need to figure out, know deeply, understand deeply, have compassion for deeply, and learn to work skillfully with this person, namely ourself, to facilitate the remediation of all our suffering and the advancement of a life that has true meaning and joy, we need to ponder deeply. Why do I do what I do? What drives me? You know, why do I act in ways that just bring me suffering? Right? And why don't I act in ways that bring me happiness and harmony? Right? In the same way, whether it's within me or in my relationships with others. So, good advice. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
You know, to follow up on what you just said, friend, is it a necessary prerequisite that we deeply understand ourselves to transform?
Well, could you define deeply understand ourselves?
Deeply.
What do you mean by
understand all our motives, all our machinations, all our interior structures, all the different things that make us up? In order to, you know, how deeply is
yeah. I mean, how much therapy do we need before we can? When can we ever stop? Right?
I don't mean just intellectually.
No, I understand. Yeah. Obviously, when you look at traditional Buddhist teachings, especially on the meditative path. There is not all that much outward emphasis on self-knowledge in the way you're talking. Really understanding my story, understanding my issues, understanding what caused them. I mean, actually, traditionally, there isn't a lot of emphasis, and especially in Zen and Dzogchen, the emphasis is just go right to the root, go right to the nature of self, the nature of reality, and blow the whole thing apart. The problem is that most of us are not at that level to do that. Okay? There are many, many people, and I think it's really the experience of Dharma here in the West over these last 20, 30, 40 years, that without some of the self-work, without some of the healing and understanding, it is often very difficult for people to make any kinds of significant advancement in meditative practice and in the true seeing deeply, because our issues keep getting in the way and we don't even see it. Right. So I think it is much more the case these days in terms of American Buddhism that there is more heed. You know, if you look, go back 20, 30, 40 years ago, there are all these things, you know, Buddhism is not psychotherapy. You know what I mean? There's like very clear distinctions. And that's certainly, in a certain case, it is not like what we consider psychotherapy. But on the other hand, Buddhism has everything to do with the eradication of suffering. Right? Mm-hmm. And certainly Buddhism places prime emphasis for an individual suffering on their own mind, right? Their own conditioned mind. So having some understanding of the way our conditioning mind causes us to suffer or causes us to continually engage even though, quote-unquote, we know better, right? Probably points to a need to do some healing or self kind of work. Again, I think the important thing from the point of view of Buddhist practice is this self-work is always in the purpose of the remediation of suffering and the capacity to stabilize, right, and harmonize, pacify, you know, the emotional afflictions and the acting out behavior, you know, negative behavior that we participate in. So as opposed to some kinds of therapeutic analysis, which just goes on and on, you know, it's like, how much can I know about myself? How much of my past do I have to understand? I think it's I could say, if there's a, to me, if there's a, if there is a paradigm, it's, you know, enough that we are no longer inhibited by it. Okay?
In our spiritual.
In your spiritual path. You know, there's a, I forget who coined the term, but it's, I think it's kind of widespread now, and it's, they called it spiritual bypassing. I don't know if people are familiar with spiritual bypassing. John Wellwood, you know, and it's, and it, people express it in different ways. And again, it really speaks to, you know, and again, I can't speak to, you know, traditional Buddhism, because it might have had the people and the cultures might have been very different than ours. But unfortunately, and it's not to say things were different, but in a certain sense they're different, there's much more awareness. But many people, such as ourselves, often comes to the spiritual path, especially the paths of Zen or Dzogchen, the more meditative path, which emphasize awakening, enlightenment, real spiritual transformation. So we come with a great aspiration. You know, we've read some stuff. We've read the masters. We've read the teachings. And we're excited by the idea of, you know, the Buddhist teaching of, you know, cessation of suffering is possible. Right? Full awakening to all my potential and to experience a life with harmony and ease and joy, etc., is possible, you know, which is clearly in the Buddhist teaching. So we get very excited by that, right? And many of us, when we come to the Buddhist path, often are involved in some degree, more or less, of a significant personal and interpersonal suffering, at ease, alienation, you know, etc., etc. So we what? We want to jump right in, don't we? Jump right into the meditative path. Jump right into the to this wonderful path, and leave that muck behind. Right? We want nothing to do with it. Right? And so we're excited by the idea. Oh, I can just meditate. I can just meditate. I can just zero in on it, and somehow I can just, you know, bypass the garbage that I've collected over at least this lifetime, if not lifetimes. Right? And again, not denying that there aren't spiritual people of great meditative capacity who can do that. But I've met many people along the way who, even if they're not great spiritual spiritual lights, can also, through by putting themselves in a very structured situation, like long retreats or lots of retreats, or you go to a retreat center or monastery for a long time, and you put yourself in a highly structured environment where there's very little external stimulation, especially of one's stuff, that one can kind of, in a very narrow laboratory way, make quote-unquote spiritual advancement. But even those people, their spiritual advancement still, this is my own personal view, gets contaminated by their garbage, which they still have not dealt with.
They carry that along,
and it contaminates their own spiritual experiences and insights. They can't live them. Why can't they live them? Because the basic foundation of their personality is still skewed, is still contaminated by a dysfunctional self and their issues. So that kind of idea that somehow I can bypass. I can bypass myself, I can bypass my history, I can bypass my issues and get and leap to this enlightened state, and then everything will be transformed, is a fairy tale. Not a complete fairy tale, but certainly a fairy tale. And so I think it makes much more sense to realize that, I mean, it's not like 1, 2, 3, 4. I think this is part of the genius of Thich Nhat Hanh, who, again, Thich Nhat Hanh is a very one of the more unusual teachers who came here from Asia, because he came here without an agenda to be a teacher and to teach. He really was here for a long time, just kind of living with Westerners and observing us deeply and doing his best to understand that. Because of circumstances, found himself in the role of teaching, he understood that many, many people who come to Dharma with the best intentions and ideals are often carry wounds. Some carry wounds of some significance, some carry wounds of profound significance. And that if these wounds are not attended to, if there is not some involvement in self-healing, in healing those wounds, the capacity of that individual to make any kind of significant advancement on the path is severely limited. And I've seen that myself over many years, that many people very sincerely practice the meditative path and the insight path for years and years, and really, even though along the way they develop some degree of capacity of meditation on the mat or on retreats or in structured activities, and even though they have insights in the way, their life is still, their personal life and their relationships are still characterized by much suffering. Okay. Why? Because they have not dealt with their wounds. So I think ties Thich Nhat Hanh's kind of path, in which one is at the same time one is following the path of mindfulness, the path of concentration, the path of insight. One is also following the path of self-healing, because it's interesting, as practitioners of the path, we say what? We say we want to follow this bodhisattva path. We want to follow this path of alleviating the suffering of all beings. This is the vow we make. And yet many of us are not aware, present, acknowledging that there's somebody very close to them, namely themselves, who is suffering. Right? And so the idea that somehow we want to alleviate the suffering of all beings but leave out ourself, seems kind of, blind, narrow, or something. So I think it's certainly important that in our undertaking of this path, that we focus on those aspects of our personhood that are continually contributing to our suffering. And even with our meditation, and even with our reading, even with all our good intentions, continues. So that should be a sign to us. You know, speaking of the Lojong slogans, and actually I commented on this in St. Petersburg Sangha on Wednesday, with one of the slogans says, deal with volatile points. Deal with the most difficult ones first, and in difficult, what it means is those that are most difficult for us, those emotions that are most difficult for us, that cause most difficulty for us in our lives. So you know, which ones do we deal with first? Those that are obviously most disturbing to us, the most disturbing emotions, difficult emotions. So there's certainly enough in the traditional teachings to point us in that direction. I just think because. Traditional societies in which Buddhism grew, they had no therapeutic kind of level of intervention the way we do in the West, so that kind of intervention was not known. But again, having said that, I don't think we need to know everything about ourselves. I don't think we need to know. I mean, if we had to know every issue that we suffer from, we would never get on with it, would we? So I think the advice of dealing with the most difficult or the most disturbing emotions first. And again, I think if we are sort of what I said in the beginning, which is in terms of pondering, I think if we develop some capacity for self-reflection, I think it'll become obvious to us, right? Which are the emotional afflictions, which are the issues get in the way, constantly are ambushing me, constantly sabotaging my my aspirations. And those should be dealt with. If they cannot be dealt with, again, in the meditative tradition, often one way to deal with emotions or issues is just to be present to them, right? To bring them up in awareness, right? To see them for what they are, to calm them, to stabilize them, to look deeply into their nature, and which is a wonderful way of dealing with any kind of even the most volatile emotions. But that is difficult for many people. I don't know how many people have tried that way. I think you need a certain degree of meditative stability to be able to hold a strongly held emotion, especially one that has a lot of juice for one, without getting swept away by it, right? Not getting swept away with all our reactions. Obviously, just through the practice of mindfulness, just through the practice of awareness, one can hold the emotions in mindfulness and awareness and let them arise and pass without reacting, without acting out. I think that's a wonderful way of handling it. But if you can't, or there are certain ones you can't, then you've got to kind of pull that one out and look at, what is it that's supporting that? And I think if you look deeply, you'll see the answer. Because in Buddhism, the answer, is always, because it is a universe of cause and effect, right? That whatever effect we are experiencing, we know there had to be a cause, so we know where to look. We look in causation. What causes this? What is causing this to arise in me? Even though intellectually I know better, even though I've told myself 5 million times that I'm never going to do this again, I'm never going to give in to this again, I'm never going to say this again, I'm never going to act out this way again, I'm never going to... Right? Right? I mean, we all know that we have the capability of having the most perfect, wonderful intentions in the world, and 5 minutes later, out the window. Right? Now, why is that? Because a lot of our reactive formations are strong. Right? And even though we've set the intention... that intention is like a little it's like a little seedling. It doesn't take much wind of one's habit forces, much winds of one's karmic formations just to blow it away. Okay, so our suffering will point us the way. We only need to be present to our suffering and to look deeply into our suffering, and we will see what we need to work on. Right? Mm-hmm. And again, you know, if you were sitting here tonight and you had a wound in your calf and you were bleeding, right? We would say to you, Doug, please, you're bleeding, please take care of that wound, right? And hopefully, or if you had noticed it and somebody pointed out to you, you would say, wow, I better go take care of this right away. I'm wounded, right? But unfortunately, emotional wounds, you know, that's why they often talk, there's an expression in the mental health field called the walking wounded. I don't know if anybody's ever heard that expression, the walking wounded, which means, you know, many of us have the capability of walking around with our wounds. And we can walk around and we can carry on like adults, and you know, we can go to work and we can have relations and, you know, appear quite upstanding citizens. And yet we are the walking wounded. The wounds are deep within us. You know, the promise of the Buddha, the promise of the cessation of all suffering, is the promise of wholeness. Right? And if parts of you are wounded, you can never be whole. Right? So, it is through the practices of mindfulness, concentration, and insight, and also through the practices of healing and self-healing, and all the practices of the Eightfold Path and the Six Paramitas, that one has the capacity of truly becoming whole, complete, which is our birthright. That
I needed all that.
Okay. Good. We'll take it home with you. Actually, you know, it reminds me, you know, I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, in our larger community, also in Tampa, we have about 50 people involved in a six-month intensive on the way of the Bodhisattva, this text written by Shantideva and the practices of the Bodhisattva. But there's a wonderful kind of that thing I just said a minute ago. Oh, this is verse 28. And Shantideva was this wonderful being of the 8th century India who wrote this text in verse, which many people consider one of the great, most beautiful, wondrous texts of this altruistic life of the Bodhisattva. And in verse 28 he says, "For beings long to free themselves from misery, but misery itself they follow and pursue. They long for joy, but in their ignorance destroy it, as they would their foe." Very insightful. Right? He says, "For beings long to free themselves from misery." Right? So most people want to be free of their unhappiness, want to be free of misery, want to be free of all their emotional afflictions that cause them to suffer, right? I mean, there are very few. I mean, if somebody did not want to free themselves of their misery, we would say that person's very sick, right? Most people, whether they're rich, poor, or whatever, you know, all different types, most people in terms of their own personal life and in their life of the people they love and care about would say, I would like all my loved ones, everybody I care about, to be free of misery. But then he goes, "But misery itself they follow and pursue." Right? Which means what? That even though they say, even though we say we want to be free of misery, yet we follow all kinds of activities of life with our body, all kind of activities with our speech, and all kinds of activities with our mind and thoughts that are only conducive to only one result: misery. Right? And we do it like sheep going to slaughter. Right? Even though we've gone down that path, 10,000 times. And even though if we could stop ourselves, we would know if I continue down this with this habit, with this behavior, with this addiction, with this way of relating, with these words I'm about to say, it is only going to create one thing. What is that? Misery. Suffering. Right? And yet what? We're off to the races. For beings long to free themselves from misery. But misery itself they follow and pursue. They long for joy, but in their ignorance destroy it, as they would their foe. Right? They want to, you know, we want to be happy. We want to be joyous. Right? Right? We want to have ease and equanimity in our hearts and minds. And yet, those things in life that would create that within us, he says we destroy it. As they would their foe, right? Usually enemies, people want to destroy their enemies, that he's referring to. It's kind of a military kind of analogy, right? You know, somebody who wants to harm you is your foe. And if you're a military kind of person, you would, or a warrior kind of person, you would want to destroy them, right? But he's saying, here people, they long for joy. So all the actions of body, speech, and mind, all the actions of life that we know would have the basis for creating joy, we would what? We would want to hold close to us, like our dearest friend, and yet we destroy them, like these things are our foes. Well, he goes on and on, but that reminded me. It's good to ponder in this way. You see? So even this little verse, four lines from Shantideva, is very profound. And if you're reading this text, you would want to stop and ask yourself, am I one of those? Right? You know, very personally, am I one of those? First of all, am I somebody who really wants to be free of misery, free of suffering, free of all the emotional afflictions that contaminate my heart. You know, easy to say, right? But I think it's worth asking ourselves, do I really want to? Because many times people get frustrated that they haven't achieved what they want, but I think oftentimes it's because they really, they don't want it. What? They don't want it. I mean, we all, in our life, do things, even silly things, like going to college and get a degree, right? Well, if anybody's gone to college and gotten a degree, you know it's not often the most stimulating environment, not often the most intelligent environment. it can be difficult, too, quite difficult. So people do drop out, don't they? Why do they drop out? Because along the way they realize, I thought I wanted it, but I didn't really want it. Right? Much less, I would imagine, there are many other careers or capabilities in music or art or all kinds of things, or in sports or in, you know, all kinds of things where we would, you know, I mean, if you ask anybody, said, do you want to be more fit? And most people would say, yeah, I'd like to be more fit. Then you tell them what they need to do, and most people would say, what? Well, maybe I... let me think about that. So he's saying like this. It's easy to say, I want to free myself from misery. I really am sick of... What do they say in the program? I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Yeah, but then you say it, and then the next day you get up and you do it all over again, right? So you have to reach a point where you're really sick and tired of being sick and tired, right? And then and that's when you turn. So we need to reflect on this, you know. Again, do I really want to be free of misery? Do I really want to be happy? Right? Because you might have noticed, for many of us, happiness is not a natural, spontaneous arising in the mind stream. Doesn't mean that happiness never arises in our mind stream, but as a continual presence in our mind stream, we would say that happiness and ease is often not our daily experience. Well, if we want it to be, right, then we have to really reflect very clearly on what is it in my life that I do that robs me of my own capacity for happiness, and two, what could I be doing in my life that would create the causes, the basis for happiness, right? So we always have to move for those of you who are reading the Path of the Bodhisattva, the Bodhikaratara by Shantideva, he in the first chapter he says very clearly, he talks about bodhicitta of intention and bodhicitta of activity or actualization. And he says, first you need the intention, right? But if you don't go out and do it, he says, I think he says, it is meritorious to have the intention to awaken and be of benefit to beings, but then to actually participate in the activities of that, that really is meritorious, right? So again, most human beings never even think or talk about the things we're talking about tonight, or don't even realize that freedom from suffering and a life based on happiness and meaning and well-being is possible for them. But for those who do, right, it's often many of us don't get beyond the stage of good intentions, reading, talking about it. We'll talk about it with everybody. I've read this book, or I just heard this talk, and I've read this, and they say we can really have this, and I can be happy, and I can be free of suffering, and we think because we're talking about it that therefore we've accomplished it. Unfortunately, again, when we wake up the next morning, we'll realize it's not that easy, right? So, for beings long to free themselves from misery, but misery itself they follow and pursue. They long for joy, but in their ignorance destroy it as they would their foe. So it's, please ponder this deeply. You ponder, reflect on this little verse, and you get clear, and you get so energized that you actually take it into the actualization of your life and how you live and the way you live. Then transformation becomes something real. It's not just talk. And because I think if it just stays on the level of talk, or it just stays on the level of kind of intermittent gestures in the direction of, we'll never get, we'll never get to really reap the benefits of this path. And over time, we'll get frustrated, bored, go try something else, give up for a while. I mean, many people, that's kind of the story of their spiritual life. They go from one teaching to another, one path to another, one teacher to another. Or they're in, and then they're out, and then they're in, and then they're out. And then they're out for a while, and they remember why they got in, and then they get in for a while. That doesn't work the way they want, so they get out. And that's kind of, unfortunately, the way many people practice. Which is, again, that could just be the way it is. But again, if you are somebody who really says, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, right? I'm sick of suffering, especially when I see that so much of my suffering and misery and emotional pain is all self-created. No one's creating it but myself, right? Nobody's robbing me of my capacity for joy or meaning or a happy life other than myself, right? When one sees that and really understands that, then that activates energy. But if we don't see and don't reflect in this way, it's very hard to get energetic. You know, it's hard to get energetic about a goal, especially a goal that, doesn't give immediate, gratification. It's hard to consistently put forth energy for a goal unless one really, is either trying to get away from something, but even better, trying to get toward something. Get away from suffering, get toward cessation of suffering. And again, the Buddha, going back 2,500 years ago and reaffirmed by all the teachers of the lineage for the last 2,500 years, all affirm what I'm saying, and all affirm the basic insight of the Buddha, which was cessation of suffering is possible, it is realizable, and that anyone and everyone who follows the Eightfold Path or the Six Paramitas or whatever way you want to formulate it can come to realization. Very black and white. But it's often hard for us to believe that because many of us, we suffer from in Buddhist psychology, which is considered a deadly disease. Anybody know what that deadly disease that practitioners need to be very careful not to catch? And if you have it, not to spread it? What? Self-doubt. Self-doubt. Oh, I can't do it. Other people can, but I can't. I don't have the capacity. I'm too screwed up. I'm too neurotic. Too much of a messed up childhood. I've done too many bad deeds. My mind's too scattered. I'm too busy. Etc. So doubt, self-doubt, doubt in the path, and all that is considered. Probably one of the worst things that one could come to it because it undercuts one's capacity to sincerely and wholeheartedly enter the path. One's always doubting one's capacity to transform, to heal and transform. And the Buddha, that was the Buddha's own experience, right? That he realized in his own life. That he had this capacity to awaken. And again, even though over the years, in certain traditions, the Buddha has become almost godlike, it's very clear that he was an historical being in northern India, had a mother, had a father, had a wife, had a child, did this, did that, and then lived here, lived there, taught here, taught there. So we know that he was, whatever his capacities were, he was an ordinary human being. Ordinary in the sense that he had arms and legs and eyes and ears and nose and a mind. Right? And, that's all you need. So everybody here has the basic, stuff, the basic things, the basic instruments. That is, are all you need for transformation. And again, if you thought that your issues were solid and real and significant, then you might say, my issues are so heavy, it's impossible for someone like me to ever heal and transform them. But issues have no weight. That is a figure of speech. Please understand, people talk that way. It is not true. Right? I would say to everybody here, please right now check all your issues, especially the really ones that you think are really heavy, and tell me how much they weigh. You laugh. Because why? Because what? Why do you laugh? Our issues have no weight. And somebody might say, well, they may not have no weight, but they're big, right? My issues are really big. And I would say to you, how big are they? I'd like to see one of your big issues. I mean, how big is, anybody here have a big issue and could give me the dimensions of them? And you laugh, because why? Why? It's silly. And yet we talk this way, right? Right. My issues are so heavy, my issues are so big, I can't possibly overcome them. But issues are not big, and issues don't have big weight, heavy weight. They're just what? They're made up of what? Thoughts, memories, images, feelings. That's just mind stuff. That's just mind stuff. How big is mind stuff? Well, most people think their mind's in their brain, so that kind of limits it to about that. Right? I mean, how big? How big? So this is, we need to ponder this way when we think our issues are so big and so heavy. They're not. It's because we perceive them that way and we label them that way and we treat them that way that therefore they become that way. But they will not stand up to examination. To what kind of examination? In Buddhism, meditation, it's called vipassana, to look deeply into the nature, the phenomena of the mind, thoughts, feelings, perception. When you look deeply, you'll see nothing there. Right? We can't even produce a thought. Right? Can anybody show me a thought of theirs? Especially one of those big, heavy, juicy ones. Can anybody do that? Just take it out and show me. Why not? Why can't you show me a thought? What happens when you try to grab hold of a thought in your mind? Anybody ever try to grab hold of a thought? What happens? What? Slips away immediately. You can't grab onto them. Right? I mean, this is not, I mean, I am not talking, high-level mysticism. This is not esoteric. Anybody who crosses their legs or sits down in a chair and spends any amount of time watching their mind will see this for themselves. Right? I'm sure there are many people here.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you. What's going on? Are you disagreeing with everything I say?
No, that's not my purpose.
Good. Welcome.
Yeah, you said grab a thought. That's my lead-in.
That's what?
That's my lead-in. Hiko asked this of Bodhidharma asked this of Hiko, show me your thought.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, can't find it.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, I still
need it. Right. And Hiko immediately was awakened.
Hiko.
Right. Hiko was immediately enlightened. That was his enlightenment experience right at that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it came Hiko. Bodhidharma was able to say to him, I've served before you. Hiko can go all over the world and use his mind. The point I wanted to bring out that, as a lead-in, you said about physicians. And I wanted to bring out something kind of personal. Being an African-American here,
uh-huh.
Many people think that, well, it's kind of not intellectual or whatever. Maybe I'm just intellectualizing. It can't be that way. But I found that, insofar as I can relate with my ancestors,
mm-hmm.
I can be confident. This has led me to certain understandings. To bring it to bear to what we have here is the tradition of Zen relates with a teacher and student. I think it was Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche who said one needs a tremendous sense of relationship with the lineage. It's very important. If you were, like myself, in Alabama, in the woods with the church, you have that kind of relationship. So how do you relate with that? I've seen many times, and I'll make it short, how people would, in a moment of distress, they say, Jesus, or God, how do you deal with it? Consequently, we fail to realize that the concept of sunyata, which is Sufis, can also be seen as upaya, but it only works when it's for the benefit of others.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, I ask you, am I a physician or am I a student of the Buddha?
Uh-huh.
I need it in certain moments. Ha! You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
In certain moments. Not to call upon the minimum fund. And then at the same time, I realize, and I make this the ending point. Like, for instance, in Christianity, they say turning the other cheek. Others say that, well, people say that means, you know, when someone hits you, you absorb it. For myself, as far as I've been studying the Dharma, it seems that it means that for someone of Christ's personality, of Lord Christ's personality, it's like a celestial body going around the sun, before which no effrontery can withstand. I've had to deal with that. And it seems that, like one guy said, you don't have to learn the Bible to know enough. And so I asked him again, am I a physician? And then here's a running joke.
Okay.
This question that I want to ask is a running joke, first of all. Mm-hmm. Is this. I visited a shrink once.
Mm-hmm.
Many years, my grandmother and my great grandmother found out I was Buddhist. They wanted me to talk to a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So consequently, I had both my grandmother and my great grandmother. Part Indian, as a matter. Anyway, and so I say that this little distance between the shrink and myself is not only mine alone to obsess over. This way I get all that I can from the transference experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a joke. I think you
got it. Yeah, wonderful.
So,
let me just say a couple of things about what you...
I don't weigh it.
Yeah, but a couple of things. So the anecdote that was shared first is a famous one in Zen, and it deals with sort of what we were saying tonight, but in the very Zen way, which is, it's actually one of my favorite anecdotes in Zen. Well, there are many of them, but anecdote means story, and it really speaks to the whole issue of teacher and student and that kind of transmission. Because Bodhidharma was, he was Indian, and he had brought this teaching, which became known as Zen or Chan in China. He had brought it to China, and without going into it, he had kind of gotten a little notoriety. He had been called to before the emperor. There's another great dialogue between the emperor. But anyhow, Bodhidharma, after dealing with the emperor and dealing with where he saw Buddhism had been in China for hundreds of years already, but not the meditative tradition. Bodhidharma felt these people are not ready for the direct path of awakening. So he took himself south. He went down to Shaolin, you know, which is famous for the martial arts, and that's where Bodhidharma supposedly sat facing doing meditation in a cave for 6 years. And during that period, supposedly he wouldn't teach anybody. People would come. They would hear about this hermit living up, and they would come see him, and he wouldn't teach anybody. And then the story is that Wiko was a Buddhist monk, and he had been practicing Buddhism for many years, Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist psychology, the sutras, the traditional studies, and also had done some meditation, but was still knee-deep in his suffering. And so he'd heard about Bodhidharma in the cave, and he came up to see him. And he asked Bodhidharma to teach him. Bodhidharma wouldn't even turn to look at him, wouldn't teach him. And continually he asked him, and he wouldn't teach him. So on the final day, Wiko stayed all night outside Bodhidharma's cave in the snow, cold all night, meditating. And in the morning, he actually supposedly cut off his hand and offered it to Bodhidharma to show his sincerity. Now, whether this actually happened or not, we don't know, but it might have happened or something like that. But anyhow, he basically did something to show his sincerity. You know, I'm serious. But Bodhidharma, to them, with, you know, these Chinese, they're not really serious. So there he is. So now Bodhidharma sees that he's really sincere, and then that has that dialogue where Bodhidharma asks him about his where Wiko says to Bodhidharma, please, you know, how does it go again? He says, put my, I can't remember the, yeah, you put my mind at rest or my suffering at rest, and Bodhidharma is sort of like what I did tonight, but you see the one-to-one says, because you could see, I mean, in all those Zen stories, like a lot of the stories, they're not stories. They're really very powerful personal encounters between two people. And one of the people is the teacher who is both awake but also totally present to the student and really wants to help them, totally engaged. And then the student who is totally in their conundrum, you know, they're really just totally in it. And so you can see Wiko really wants to be liberated. He's feeling the burden, the heaviness of his, like what you're saying, he's feeling the heaviness and the weight of his delusion. And he says, you know, please, master, you know, free me from my delusion. And Bodhidharma says, good, show it to me. And of course, in that instant, we know that Wiko all of a sudden turns around inside his mind, and what does he find? Nothing. This heavy, heavy weight of self and delusion and everything that he'd been carrying around, thinking, coming to release, in that instance he saw, and he says this is where he has a great awakening, and he became actually the second patriarch of Chan, of Zen, yeah. Wiko. And a wonderful story. But in terms of your question, I think that the relationship between the teacher and the student is central in the meditative tradition. Okay, it is quite possible. You know, it's like it's possible to go to college. It's possible to go through high school. It's possible, you know, and be in classes and learn a lot from teachers. But I think. In this personal path of transformation and healing, one needs to work very closely with the teacher. And I say that from my own experience. I mean, I've taken lots of teachings and I've studied lots of teachings. But the most salient thing in my own third-rate development is that I've had wonderful teachers that I've been able to relate with directly. And that is very meaningful. Because... you know, one of the problems with this work we do, the fundamental problem is self. And it's very hard for self to see itself. Right? Why? Because self is what we identify with as ourself. So we need somebody outside the self who can hold the mirror that lets you see clearly your own self, your own delusions, your own hang-ups, right? So in that case, as you said, we need a physician, right? You know, it's very hard to diagnose ourselves and assess ourselves and treat ourselves. So
my question, question is, are we students of the Buddha or are we physicians? Based upon what you said in the Bible, it says, physician, heal thyself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking maybe some sort of egoic self-ectomy. Sitting shiv on the ego, we can somehow, you know, transcend this notion of having to have another Hippocratic oath. Is there something else?
Well, it is, you know, as I'm saying, the idea behind, when I use the word physician, heal thyself, what I meant was in relationship to her question, which is, we are so good at seeing everybody else's problems, at seeing everybody else's issues, and we are so good at prescribing how we think they could change, how they think to do different, but often how blind we are to our own self. So in that sense, I wasn't inferring that we're all of the caliber of physicians, but that those of us who are so free to dispense advice to others ought to be first making sure that we're taking the advice ourselves.
One more thing, I'll say this and I'll say, you see what I mean. Ray R.E.M. has this song, Changing My Religion. You can't do that at a certain point when you are trying to realize, you know, whether I'm Buddhist or Christian. It has to be something very special. And that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and again, I think, Buddhism and Christianity are words that describe what? Paths, ways of being, ways of seeing, ways of acting, ways of action, and I'm not somebody, to be honest with you, who believes all. You know, some people say all paths are the same and all paths go to the same place. That's not true. That's like saying all roads. Maybe at one time in the world all roads went to Rome. But not these days. I mean, you know, roads go to Tampa, and roads go to St. Pete, and roads go to New York, you know. And, you know, roads go in all different directions. So people say all roads go to the same place. It's not true. Now, so not all roads go to the same place, and not all roads are the same, right? Some roads are superhighways. Some roads are two-lane roads. Some roads are gravel, rocky roads. Now, again, Even when we talk about that all these roads are going to the same place, there are still different roads, different types of roads, and different. Some go straight, some wander around. That's why I think that it's good. Most of the people sitting in this room were not born to this path, were not born to this tradition. And most people probably sitting here have done a lot of their own shopping around and comparative studies. Some of you here may still be in the shopping around phase. But at some point, I think you have to find a road, find a path, whatever it's called, that is meaningful to you and that will give you the type of transformation that you seek in your life. And then you just walk it. Just walk it, right? You know, once you decide, you know, you're in Tampa, the road's going north, south, east, well, not too much west, but I guess a little west. You know, but once you pick your road, then you just walk it. You know, you know where you want to get to. You know that this is a good road. You know this road will get you there. And then you just walk it, you know? And when you see it that way, it becomes easy, because all I have to do is keep walking. I don't have to, every three steps, think about where I'm walking, right? Or, you know, do I want to get there? Do I want to go somewhere else? Maybe there's really, you know, that's again a reason that people spend many times on paths and kind of don't get the results they really are seeking. Why they got on the road to begin with. Again, because they have doubt, because they have half-hearted commitment, because they're still looking here, looking there, the grass is always greener, something must be better, you know, they're looking for the magic pill, they're looking for somebody who says it a little differently. Buddhist teaching is very simple, isn't it? Very simple. The path is very simple. A lot of people have complicated it, but it's very simple, right? You can say it in one word, or two words, or three words. Let go. Just let go. Let go of all your attachments, let go of all your avoidances, let go of all your thoughts. Just let go. Live an awakened life. Wherever you're stuck, it's because you're holding on to something. Right? You're holding on to the past. You're holding on to a self-identity. You're holding on to an issue. You're holding on to a need, a want, an expectation. There's always something we're holding on to. You want the simple way? Just let go. And be free. Could it be that simple? Just cut. Cut. Cut it as whatever binds you. What binds you? Just ponder. You'll see it. But we believe it can't be that simple, can we? So we You know, so the Buddha's in there because we don't see it that simple. The Buddha's event, it's called Upaya. You refer to Upaya, 84,000 doors, right? For starters, right? Because we believe it can't be that simple. So give me something a little more complicated, we say. This is the last one.
Yeah.
All right, last question.
You mentioned spiritual bypasses.
Mm-hmm.
Deepak Chopra has a word for it called the superstition of materialism. And one of my most profound teachers, Chogyam Trungpa, writes spiritual materialism. He wrote that word. Okay, so we have that. But, as I understand it, if you correct me, please, Bhashyam Thor, the founder of Hasid, in one story, he said, when all that was taken from the world, and him and his assistant was on an island, and he didn't remember anything that he taught the world that was any good. So he looked at his assistant and says, "Do you remember anything?" And his assistant says, "Aleph, Beit, Dalet, Gimel." Now he became the teacher became the student. My question, are you my teacher? Is that funny?
What? Well, I only laugh because my experience with teachers is the student decides who their teacher is. The student decides who their teacher is. And then they go to their teacher, the person they've chosen to be their teacher, and they ask to be their student. I don't think teachers go around choosing students. But students should pick a teacher, somebody they have confidence in, and somebody who is in some way or another an exemplar of what they hope to accomplish in their life through the spiritual practice. Someone who they believe in terms of their conduct, and, you know, are not hypocritical, but actually live the truth of the teaching. And then, I've had probably three major teachers in my life, several minor teachers, several root teachers, and several non-root teachers. Having an individual relationship with a spiritual teacher, again, is something as Americans we're not used to, right? Usually in our Western religion, we have congregations. And congregations as a whole have a pastor, a reverend, a priest, a rabbi, an imam or something. And so everybody has a relationship. But in Zen and Dzogchen, it's a very different thing. It's a much personal, more intimate, because in a certain way, you are not just asking somebody for intellectual teaching, but you're asking for a kind of transmission. You know, if you think about about Zen, and again, the story is apocryphal, one doesn't know, but we supposedly the first, the transmission of Zen, of what became known as Zen, went from the Buddha to one of his disciples, Mahakashapa. And we know the Buddha had many disciples, many students, many close students. But the transmission to Mahakashapa supposedly was the wordless transmission. Basically, one day, everybody would gather after the morning begging round. In the afternoon, the Buddha traditionally would teach. All the disciples gathered around, and this supposedly on this day, and anybody who's read sutras know the Buddha would talk on, give great teachings and answer whatever they want. But this day, when people inquired about a teaching, he held up a flower. Right? And according to the story, mostly everybody either looked somewhat confused or a little disappointed. They wanted to come to hear him say something, but only Mahakashapa had a smile of knowingness, understood what a profound teaching the Buddha had just transmitted. And so that is why the transmission of Zen is considered wordless, and, you know, outside of the transmission of words, but also very personal. I mean, in that moment, something was transmitted from the Buddha to Mahakashapa, but please don't think it was the flower. So we'll end there. It's 8:30. Thank you all. So don't forget, let go. And relax. I'll add that. Relax. When you let go, you just relax. Relax the mind, relax the body, be at ease. And just see. Every time you suffer this week, see if there's any constriction, any tightening. Ask yourself, what am I holding on to right now?